Any time to abandon ship, it was now, so I bailed. The sled went one way and I went the other. For a moment, I was airborne. And then I beefed. Hard. The snow wasn't as deep anymore, so instead of a nice, cushy snow landing, I hit hard ground. It knocked the wind out of me and slammed my head against the ground. The world became a spinning mass of white. I couldn't think. I couldn't breathe. But I wasn't moving anymore. And that was good. I'm not sure how long I lay there because I was drifting in and out of consciousness. Then I remember hearing something odd. It was far off at first, but it was coming close, very fast. I feared that the Quigs had finished their lunch and caught up with us for dessert. But this didn't sound like them. This sounded like horses. Galloping horses. More than one. And then I heard Uncle Press calling to me.
Bobby! Bobby, if you can hear me, don't move! Stay where you are! The Milago will find you! They'll help you!
What did he mean? What were the Milago? I had to see what was happening. I rolled over on my side, which really hurt, by the way. I must have smashed a couple of ribs in the fall. I didn't stand up, though. I'm not sure I could have, even if I wanted to. My head hurt, and I was really dizzy, but I clawed at the snow and crawled toward Uncle Press's voice. There was a little rise of snow, probably the one that launched me into space, and I painfully crawled toward it on my belly. When I got to it, I cautiously peeked over the top. I was relieved to see Uncle Press standing on the edge of the clearing, not far from me. He was okay. Come to think of it, he looked a lot better than I felt right then. To the far right of the clearing, closing fast on him, were the horses I heard. And there were riders on the horses. Four of them. They looked to me like ancient knights. They wore black armor made of heavy leather. They had black leather helmets with faceplates as well. Even their horses had similar leather protection. They all looked the same, as if the armor were some kind of uniform. I also saw that they had swords. They looked to me like something out of the Knights of the Round Table. Uncle Press gave them a friendly wave as they circled him.
"Hello," he called out in a friendly voice. "How are you this fine day?"
We weren't in America. We weren't even on Earth. Why did Uncle Press think these guys spoke English?
"Butu! Butu aga forden!"
shouted one of the knights brusquely. I was right. They didn't speak English.
"No," answered Uncle Press. "I am hunting rabbits for my family."
"Soba borfiu!"
barked another knight. This was weird. They were speaking some bizarro language and Uncle Press was speaking English, yet they both seemed to understand each other. I, on the other hand, understood nothing. What else is new? The first knight pointed a finger at Uncle Press and started shouting,
"Butu! Butu aga forin kadar!"
This looked bad. Whatever Butu meant, I didn't think it was a compliment. Uncle Press raised his arms innocently and shrugged, as if he didn't know what they were talking about.
"No," he said with a smile. "Why would I spy on Kagan? I'm a miner who only cares about feeding his family."
Spy? Miner? Kagan? My head started to throb. And then things turned sour. The first knight pulled a nasty-looking bullwhip off his saddle and slashed it at Uncle Press. Whap! It wrapped around his arm. Uncle Press let out a yelp of pain, and the knight yanked on the whip, pulling him to his knees. I tried to get up and run to him, but the pain in my side shot through my body and I lost my breath again. My head started to spin. I was seconds from losing consciousness. But I kept my eyes riveted on Uncle Press. Two of the other knights took ropes from their saddles and lassoed him like a steer in a rodeo. Then they kicked their horses and took off across the field, dragging Uncle Press along on his back. That's the last thing I saw. These laughing black knights on their horses, dragging my uncle across the snow. as they disappeared into the woods. I lost it. My head was spinning out of control. I was going down. The last thing I remember thinking was that what seemed like only a few hours before, I had been standing in my kitchen throwing the tennis ball for Marley to fetch. And I hoped somebody remembered to take her out for her nighttime walk. Then everything turned white, and I was gone. End of Journal Number 1. Second Earth. Mark Diamond paced nervously as Courtney Chetwin sat on her backpack in the empty lot at 2 Linden Place, reading the parchment pages. He wanted her to read faster. He wanted her to look up and tell him that everything was okay. He wanted her to find a clue somewhere in the pages that proved none of this could be real. But most of all, he wanted to turn around and see that Bobby's house was back where it should be. Courtney took her time reading the pages, and when she finally finished, she looked up at Mark with a curious expression. "Where did you get this?" she asked, with no emotion. Mark dug into his pocket and pulled out the strange ring with the gray stone. After what happened in the boys' bathroom, there was no chance he was going to put the cursed piece of jewelry back on his finger. "It came from this thing," he said, while holding the ring out gingerly. "It was like alive. There were flashing lights, and it got big and opened up this hole, and there was a sound, and suddenly the pages were just there." Courtney looked at the ring, looked back at the parchment papers. Mark could tell the wheels were turning in her head as she tried to make sense of everything he had just thrown at her. Finally, she stood up and tossed the parchment papers over her shoulder like yesterday's news. "Give me a break," she said with a sneer.
"Hey!"
squealed Mark as he frantically ran after the pages. There was a slight wind that scattered them across the empty lot, so he had to scramble before they blew away. "What do you guys think I am?" Courtney barked. "Some kind of idiot?"
"No, it's not like..."
Mark's stutter was back.
"You tell Bobby Pendragon that I'm not dumb enough to go for such a stupid joke."
But
what happens next? Am I supposed to get all worried and tell everybody that Bobby missed the game last night because he got flumed into another dimension and had to battle cannibal beasts? And unless he rescues his uncle from some dark knights on horseback, he might miss the next game, too?"
"Well, yeah."
"Oh, yeah, that's perfect," shouted Courtney. "Then Bobby jumps out and yells, 'Surprise!' And I have to move to another state because no one will ever let me forget that I was dumb enough to fall for the most ridiculous practical joke in the history of practical jokes. I don't think so."
With that, she snatched up her pack and started to walk away.
"Courtney, stop!"
shouted Mark. Courtney wheeled back to Mark, throwing him a look of total disdain. When you get a look like that from Courtney Chetwynd, it's really hard not to quickly dig a hole and bury yourself in it. It took every bit of strength for Mark to go on. When he spoke, it was sincere and without a trace of a stutter.
"It's hard for me to believe it, too," he began. "But this isn't a joke. I don't know if everything in those pages is true, but I've seen some things that I can't explain. I swear I have. And it's enough to make me believe something totally bizarre happened to Bobby."
Courtney didn't move. Was she starting to believe him? Or was she just waiting for him to finish so she could tell him again what an idiot she thought he was? Mark took the chance and continued.
"I know it's a lot to swallow, but if this is all just some big old practical joke, then where's Bobby's house?"
Courtney looked past Mark to the empty lot. Mark wondered what she was thinking. Was she remembering how she had come to this spot last night, gone inside a house that was no longer here, and kissed Bobby Pendragon?
"I'm scared, Courtney," added Mark. "I want to know what happened, but I don't think I can figure it out by myself."
Courtney stared at Mark for a moment more, as if trying to read his mind. She then walked past him to stand in the center of the empty lot. She did a slow 360 around to take everything in. But there was nothing to take in.
there wasn't a shred of evidence to show that a family of four with a dog had lived there not 12 hours before. Courtney was the kind of person who was always on top of things. It didn't matter if it was a game of volleyball or an argument with her parents. Courtney always knew how to handle difficult situations and turn them to her advantage. But this was different. She couldn't control this situation because she didn't know the rules. Yet. "All right," she said thoughtfully. "We can't go crazy trying to figure out everything at once. It's just too much." She was half talking to Mark and half thinking out loud. "I don't know anything about quigs or travelers or plumes."
"Flumes,"
he corrected her.
"Whatever,"
she snapped back.
"That's all fantasy to me. But this house being gone is about as real as it gets. If we can find out what happened to the house, maybe that'll point us toward Bobby."
Mark smiled for the first time in forever. He had an ally, and it was somebody he knew could make things happen.
"Where do we start?" he asked.
Courtney started to walk toward the street with her long, bold strides. She was now on a mission.
"We've got to find his parents. No way they disappeared, too."
"Excellent!" shouted Mark. They were moving forward. Courtney suddenly stopped, whirled around, and went nose to nose with Mark.
"And I swear, Diamond," she said while jabbing him in the chest with a strong finger, "if you're pulling my chain about all this, I'll slam you so hard you'll have to reach up to tie your shoes."
"So noted," gulped Mark.
Courtney continued on toward the street. Mark followed while stuffing the parchment papers into his pack. As he was about to step onto the sidewalk, he took one last look back at the empty space where his best friend's house used to be. He could understand where Courtney's disbelief was coming from. The story contained in the parchment papers was tough to believe, even though some of it had proven to be true. At least, the part about Courtney, that is. That was the easy part. The rest was just plain incredible. And there was a mystery, too. Nowhere in the pages did Bobby say anything about his house disappearing. If everything had played out the way the pages said, when he and his Uncle Press took off on the motorcycle, the house was still here. Something happened to it after they were gone, which meant Bobby didn't know that his house was history. Oddly enough, this gave Mark some hope. Courtney was right. If they could figure out what happened to the house, then maybe they could make some sense out of what happened to Bobby. There was another thought that nagged at the back of Mark's mind, and it was one he didn't feel comfortable sharing with Courtney. At least, not yet. It had to do with the ring and the fact that Bobby sent the pages to him. The question that Mark kept asking himself was, why? If all that Bobby wrote about were true and he was on a most incredible adventure, then why would he take the time to write down everything that happened and send it to him? Sure, they were best friends, and Bobby wrote that he hoped the pages would someday prove that he wasn't making everything up, but that didn't seem to be enough to justify doing it. Mark felt that somehow there was an important reason that he should know about what was happening to Bobby. For now, he was happy just to be on the road to making sense of what had happened to his best friend. The logical place to start would be to find Bobby's parents and ask them what happened to the house. So, with that positive thought in mind, Mark turned his back on the empty lot and ran to catch up with Courtney. They were both sure that their questions would soon be answered. They would find Bobby, and life would return to normal in time for school the next day. They couldn't have been more wrong. Their investigation first took them to Mark's house. They figured it would be easier to track down Bobby's parents over the phone than by racing around town on their bikes or by taking the bus. Mark lived on a cul-de-sac about a half a mile from Bobby's house. Rather, half a mile from where Bobby's house used to be. Of course, when he left for school that morning, Mark hadn't anticipated that the fabulous Courtney Chetwynd would be paying a visit to his bedroom that afternoon. The odds of that happening were roughly the same as, well, his best friend being launched across the universe.
"Wait here,"
commanded Mark as he ran into his bedroom and closed the door in Courtney's face. Courtney rolled her eyes, but respected his privacy. Mark took one look at his room and wanted to faint. He wasn't sure which was the most embarrassing, the dirty underwear and socks that were scattered everywhere, the cartoon superhero posters that he hadn't gotten around to taking down, the Sports Illustrated bikini posters that he had just gotten around to putting up, or the rancid smell that seemed to permeate the whole squalid mess. Mark went into overdrive. He threw open a window, scooped up an armload of the offending Fruit of the Looms, and jammed as many as he could fit behind the pillow of his unmade bed. Then the door opened and Courtney charged in.
"Look, I've got two older brothers. It's not possible to gross me out."
She took a look at the room and stopped dead in her tracks. Mark stood frozen, holding a bunch of dirty gray socks that, in an earlier life, had actually been white. Courtney sniffed the air and had to try hard not to gag.
"I was wrong. I am totally grossed out," she managed to say. "Did something die in here?" "Sorry," he said, in complete embarrassment. "It needs a little air. It needs fumigation. Open another window before I pass out," gagged Courtney.
Mark tossed his bunch of socks out of one window and quickly threw open another. Courtney surveyed the room, stopping in front of two posters on the wall. One was a colorful anime superhero cartoon. The other was a gorgeous girl lying on a tropical beach in a leopard print thong. Courtney said,
"Looks like you've got kind of a conflicted puberty versus play school thing going on."
Mark stood in front of the posters, blocking them.
"Can we focus on the important problem, please?" he said curtly.
Courtney got the message. Now wasn't the time to be giving Mark grief. She sat down at his desk as he quickly cleared off the F-117 model plane he had been building in order to give her room to work.
"Phone book," she said.
"All business." Mark went to his closet in search of one. Courtney found a scratch pad of paper and opened a desk drawer to look for a pen. Big mistake.
"Well, I solved one mystery," she announced.
"What?"
asked Mark hopefully. Courtney reached into his drawer and pulled out a revolting-looking block of yellow ooze.
"I know why your room smells like a shoe," she said, holding out a rotten piece of moldy cheese as if it were diseased.
It probably was.
Mark instantly grabbed it. "Hey, I've been looking for that," he exclaimed.
Courtney rolled her eyes and grabbed the phone book Mark had found. The plan was to call Bobby's parents at work. Mr. Pendragon was a writer for the local newspaper, and Mrs. Pendragon was the assistant librarian in town. Courtney found both numbers and called both places. Unfortunately, she got the same disturbing information each time. Neither of Bobby's parents had shown up for work that day, and neither had called in to say why. That was bad. She then called Glenville School, where Bobby's sister, Shannon, was in the third grade. Again, she got the same answer. Shannon hadn't come to school that day. After hearing this last bit of information, Courtney slowly put the phone back down in the cradle and looked to Mark.
"They're all missing," she said soberly.
Mark quickly grabbed the phone and dialed a number.
"Who are you calling?"
asked Courtney.
"I'm dialing Bobby's number."
He did, and what he got was a recorded message from the operator that said,
"The number you have reached is not in service."
Mark slammed the phone down.
"That's impossible," he shouted. "I just called him yesterday. A whole family can't just vanish."
On a hunch, Courtney took the phone book and flipped through it. She got to the P section and searched for Pendragon. She checked, double-checked, triple-checked, and then announced,
"It's not here. Their name isn't here."
Mark grabbed at the book and looked for himself. Courtney was right. There was no listing for Pendragon.
"Is their number unlisted?"
asked Courtney.
"No,"
answered Mark quickly. This seemed to upset him more than anything else.
And I'll tell you something else. Bobby and I looked up his number in this very book about a year ago. I was goofing around and next to Pendragon I wrote sucks. I know, lame joke, but I did it. And now it's not there. It's not erased, it's not cut out, it's just not there. Like it was never there.
This had gotten out of hand. A whole family was missing. There was only one thing to do. They had to report it to the police. This wasn't the kind of thing they wanted to do over the phone, so the two of them headed right for the Stony Brook police station. Stony Brook was a little town in Connecticut that wasn't exactly a center for criminal activity. There was an occasional robbery or fight, but most of the time the Stony Brook Police Department kept itself busy by making sure people obeyed the traffic laws and cleaned up after their dogs. When Courtney and Mark walked into the police station, they weren't exactly sure what they were going to say. They decided that they would stick to the obvious facts, which were that Bobby and his family were nowhere to be found, and that their house was gone. Telling them about the ring and the parchment and the wild story that supposedly came from Bobby would be a bit much to throw at them at first. They spoke to a policeman by the name of Sergeant D'Angelo sitting behind the large front desk. Courtney did the talking. Mark was too nervous. She explained how Bobby hadn't shown up for the game last night and didn't come to school today. She told them how they had gone to the Pendragon's house to find that it wasn't there anymore, and none of the other family members were where they should have been. Sergeant D'Angelo listened to everything they had to say and took notes on a form. Courtney had the strange feeling that the policeman didn't believe a word they were saying, but he had to go through the motions because it was his job. After he finished the form, he walked away from the front desk and went to his computer. He clicked away on the keyboard, read the screen, and occasionally glanced back to Mark and Courtney. Was he scowling? Finally, he stood up and came back to the desk to face them.
"Look, kids," he said with a frown. "I don't know what you're trying to pull here, but you're wasting my time and taxpayers' money."
Mark and Courtney were stunned.
"What are you talking about?" asked Courtney. "Didn't you listen? A family is missing. Isn't that the kind of thing the Stony Brook police should be worried about?"
This didn't impress Sergeant D'Angelo.
"Pendragon, right?" he said. "To Linden Place?"
"That's right," answered Mark.
"I just went through the town registry," said the sergeant with force. "There is no family by that name living in Stony Brook. There is no house on 2 Linden Place. There has never been a house on 2 Linden Place. So the only possible explanation is that you're either pulling some kind of joke or you're talking about a family of ghosts. And no, the Stony Brook police are not interested in tracking down a family of ghosts."
With that, he tore up the form he was filling out and tossed it in the wastebasket. Courtney was livid. She was all set to leap over that desk, grab the smug cop, and force him to go to their school, where everybody knew Bobby. She might have done it, too, except for one thing. The ring in Mark's pocket started to twitch. Mark's heart instantly leaped into his throat. Courtney leaned closer to the desk, looked up at the cop, and said angrily,
"I don't care what your computer says. I know the Pendragons. Bobby is my—"
Mark grabbed Courtney by the hand and pulled her back with such force it actually made her stop talking.
"We gotta go,"
was all Mark could say. In his pocket, the ring was starting to shake harder.
"No way! I'm not going until Courtney, let's go!"
He shot her a look that was so intense she got the message. She didn't know what was going on, but she knew Mark was serious. Mark backed toward the door, pulling Courtney with him. But Courtney wanted the last word with D'Angelo.
"I'm coming back," she shouted. "And you better hope those people are okay, or it's going to be on your head."
Mark pulled her out of the door, leaving Sergeant D'Angelo alone. The policeman sniffed, shook his head, and went back to reading the newspaper. Outside of the station, Mark pulled Courtney into an alley to get away from the main street. Though Courtney was bigger and stronger than Mark, he would not be denied.
"What is your problem?" she shouted.
Mark dug into his pocket and pulled out the ring.
This,
he said, while holding it out in front of him. The gray stone had already turned crystalline, and rays of light once again shot from its center. Courtney watched in wonder as Mark placed the ring on the pavement and took a few steps back. The ring twitched, flipped over, and started to grow.
Oh, my God,
Courtney breathed, dumbfounded. Within the growing circle was a black portal where the road should have been. From this portal came the musical notes that Mark had heard in the boys' room at school. The sparkling lights flashed against the walls of the buildings, and even though it was daytime, they shone so brightly that Courtney and Mark had to shield their eyes. The musical notes grew louder, the stone gave off one last blinding flash, and that was it. The lights ended, and the music stopped.
"Is that it?"
asked Courtney. Mark walked cautiously over to the ring. It sat on the road, right where he had left it. It was once again back to normal size, and the stone had returned to its original gray color. But something else was there, too. Lying next to the ring was another scroll of parchment paper tied with a leather cord. Mark reached down, picked it up gingerly, and turned to Courtney.
"Mail's in,"
was all he could say. Journal Number 2. Denderon.
Uncle Press is going to die tomorrow. So much has happened since I wrote to you last, Mark. It's been strange, scary, confusing, and sometimes even sort of, dare I say it, fun. But the bottom line is, Uncle Press is going to die tomorrow. Right now I'm sitting in a small cavern that must be 200 feet underground. I'm writing this by the light of a candle because there's no electricity. I'm looking around, and all I see are rocks. Tons and tons of black rocks that look as if they might collapse on my head at any second. I'd better stop thinking about it because I'm freaking myself out. The cavern isn't going to collapse. I'm safe here, at least for now. The guy who is in trouble is Uncle Press. I'm telling you this because I need your help. I'm going to ask you to do something for me that is pretty dangerous. Under normal circumstances, I'd never ask you to do something like this, but it's the only thing I can think of that might help me save Uncle Press. I'd understand if you didn't want to do it, but before you decide, I want to tell you all that's happened since the last time I wrote you. Once you know everything, then you can decide. I ended my last letter right after Uncle Press was dragged off by Kagan's knights, and I blacked out. Have you ever blacked out or fainted? It's not like falling asleep at all. When you fall asleep, you never know the exact moment it happens. You just kind of lie there, waiting, and the next thing you know, bang, is morning. But when you pass out, you can feel yourself slipping away. It's not a good feeling. Waking up afterward isn't much better. There's a moment where you're not really sure where you are and what's going on. Then suddenly everything rushes into focus, and you're snapped back to reality. It's a pretty rude experience. Of course, in this case, even after I snapped back to reality, I still didn't know where I was and what was going on. The first thing I saw was a face. A girl's face. For a second, I thought it was Courtney. But once my brain started to click, I realized this girl didn't look anything like Courtney. She was totally beautiful. Whoa, that sounded bad. Not that Courtney isn't totally beautiful, but this girl was, well, different. I'd say she was my age, maybe a little older. She had dark skin and eyes that were so brown they looked black. Her hair was dark, too. It was tied in a long, tight braid that reached halfway down her back. She wore the same kind of weird leather skins that Uncle Press had made me put on, but on her they looked pretty good because she had an amazing body. She had to be an athlete or something. Seriously, this girl was cut like an Olympic sprinter. No fat, all muscle. Totally awesome. And she was tall. Maybe a few inches taller than me. If I saw her at home, I'd guess she was of African descent. But this wasn't home. I lay flat on my back as she looked down at me with absolutely no expression.
I couldn't tell if she was glad I was alive or getting ready to finish the job the Quig started and kill me once and for all. We stayed that way for a few seconds, with neither of us moving. Finally, I swallowed to make sure my voice would work and croaked out, "Where am I?" No points for originality, but hey, I wanted to know. The girl didn't answer. She stood up and walked to a table that had a couple of wooden bowls. She picked one up and held it out for me. But I didn't take it. Who knows what she was trying to give me? It could have been poison. It could have been blood. It could have been some vile-tasting liquid that they consider a delicacy here, but would make me puke.
"It is water," she said flatly.
Oh. I took it. I was thirsty. The girl then walked over to the door and stood with her arms folded. I took a drink and looked around to get my bearings. I was inside what looked like some kind of hut. It wasn't big, maybe the size of my living room at home. There was only one room with six walls. Is that a hexagon? The walls were built of stones that were held together by dried mud. There were a few holes which passed for windows, and one big opening for a door. The ceiling rose to a center point and was made of interwoven tree branches. The floor was dirt, but it was so hard it might as well have been concrete. I was lying on a low bench thingy that was made out of lashed together logs. The top was woven out of straw or something. It was comfortable enough, but I wouldn't want to spend a whole night there. There was a bunch more of these beds lined up in the hut, which made me think this might be some kind of hospital. It made sense. After what I'd been through, I belonged in a hospital. It was like I had stepped into a time machine and been sent back a few thousand years to an age when people built their world out of anything they could get their hands on and didn't care much for personal hygiene. Oh, yes, did I mention the place smelled like a locker room for goats? It made me wonder if the mortar holding together the stone walls was really mud, or something disgusting that would make me wretch if I knew what it was. I looked over at this amazing girl. She stood there, staring back. Was she a friend? An enemy? A guard who was standing watch until one of those night guys came in to drag me off like they did Uncle Press? A million thoughts ran through my head. But one thought stood out above all others. I had to pee. The last time I took a leak was before Courtney showed up at my house. When was that? A million years ago? Judging by how my bladder felt, it was at least that long. So rather than lie there and wet my leather pants, I started to get up. "Hey," I said, "I gotta..." As soon as I moved, the girl flew into attack mode. She instantly crouched down and whipped out a wooden pole that must have been strapped to her back. It was about 5 feet long and well-worn from use. She held the weapon steady with both hands, and I saw that each end was stained shiny black from hitting things I didn't even want to imagine. Scarier still were her eyes. They were dead-set focused on her target, which happened to be me. I froze. No way I was going to stand up or she would have whacked me so fast my head would hit the ground before my feet did. I didn't want to move at all for fear of setting her off. We both stayed that way, waiting for the other one to make the next move. One thing I knew for sure, it wasn't going to be me. And if she took a step toward me, I'd be off that bench and out the window head first. Then a voice called from outside.
"Buzzup says Woosaga."
At least that's what it sounded like. I'm not exactly sure of the spelling. Someone stepped in through the door. It was a woman dressed in the same crusty leather clothes that apparently were fashionable in this neighborhood. She actually looked like an older version of the girl who was about to brain me. But as powerful as this woman looked, there was something about her that made me feel as if she could possibly be my savior. I think it was her eyes. They were kind eyes. No anger there at all. When she looked at me, I knew it was going to be okay. She looked familiar, though I can't imagine where I could have met her before. She gave the younger girl a stern look, and the girl reluctantly responded by putting her weapon away.
Phew! Disaster averted.
The woman then turned to me and said,
"Forgive my daughter. She often takes herself too seriously."
New info. This was a mother-daughter team. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. They looked alike. I wondered what Dad looked like. He must have been a linebacker. I still didn't feel comfortable moving. This woman seemed cool, but after what I'd been through, I wasn't taking any chances. She walked up to me, knelt down by the bench, and gave me a kind smile.
"My name is Osa," she said softly. "My daughter's name is Lor."
I'm Bobby, and I'm not from here," was all I could think of saying.
With a smile, Osa said,
"Neither are we, and we know exactly who you are, Pendragon. We've been waiting for you."
Whoa! She knew who I was!
A million thoughts flashed through my brain, but one in particular jumped out. If they knew who I was, then why was Amazon Girl over there ready to beat my brains out? I figured I'd better not ask. I didn't want to tick Lore off. She might decide to yank out her stick and start wailing on me anyway.
"How do you know me?"
I asked.
"From press, of course," she answered. "He has been telling us about you for quite some time."
That's right. Now I remember where I'd seen her before. Uncle Press had brought her to our house. We had met before. I remember thinking how beautiful she was, and how odd it was that she didn't speak. The mystery was over. She was a friend of Uncle Press's.
But that realization was quickly replaced with another.
Man, I'd almost forgotten. Uncle Press was in trouble.
At least, I think he was in trouble. Those night boys who lassoed him and pulled him off didn't exactly look like his pals. A rush of adrenaline shot through my body and I sat up fast.
"He's in trouble!" I shouted.
Bad move. Not the shouting part, the sitting up fast part. My body was one big black and blue mark from our bobsled crash in the forest. A wave of pain hit me like that stick would have hit me if Lore were taking batting practice on me. I don't know why I didn't realize it before, but I was really hurt. It felt like every one of my ribs was cracked. The pain was so intense, it took my breath away. My legs went weak, and I had to lie back down, or I would have passed out again. Osa quickly grabbed my shoulders and gently lowered me back on the bench.
"It is all right," she said in a soothing voice. "The pain will not last."
How could she know that?
Unless maybe she thought I was about to die. Nothing short of death was going to stop this burning pain any time soon. But what happened next was nothing short of amazing. I lay there taking short, quick breaths, because deep breaths made the pain even worse. Osa then reached out and gently put her hand on my chest. She looked into my eyes, and I swear, Mark, it was like I melted. The tension totally flew out of me.
"Relax," she said softly. "Breathe slowly."
I did. Soon my heart stopped pounding and I could take a deep breath. But most amazing of all, the pain went away. I swear, a second before I was hurting so bad I couldn't even cry. Now it was gone. Completely. Osa took her hand away and glanced over to Lore for a reaction. Lore turned away. She wasn't impressed. But I sure was. It was some kind of miracle.
"How did you do that?"
I asked, while sitting up and feeling my ribs.
"Do what?"
was Osa's innocent reply.
"Are you kidding?"
I shouted.
"My ribs! I was like dying. You touched me and poof, I'm off injured reserve."
Osa stood up and said,
"Perhaps you were not hurt as badly as you thought."
"Yeah, right," I shot back. "I know what pain is, especially when it's mine." That's when Lore decided to join the party.
"We are wasting time," she said in a peeved voice. "Press is being held by Kagan."
I didn't care much for Lore's style, but she was right. "Who is this Kagan dude?" I asked.
"There are many things you must learn," said Osa. "Press was to begin teaching you, but until he returns, the task will be mine. Come."
She walked over to the hole in the wall that was a door and stood next to her daughter. They both looked at me, which I took as my cue to follow. I stood up, ready to feel the pain in my ribs shoot back. It didn't. Amazing! I then looked at Lore to see if she would spring into attack mode again. She didn't. So far, so good.
"Shouldn't we find Uncle Press?" I asked. "We will," responded Osa. "But first, you must learn about Denduron."
Denduron, right. That's where I was. There wasn't much I liked about Denduron so far, and I couldn't imagine finding out anything else that would make me like it any more. But I didn't have a whole lot of options, so I followed the others toward the door. I took two steps and then stopped, remembering something very, very important.
Where do I go to, you know, I've got to,
"Relieve yourself in there,"
Lore said coldly, pointing to a far corner of the room where there was a wooden screen separating a small space from the rest of the hut.
"Oh, great, thanks,"
I replied, and hurried toward it. When I looked behind the screen, I learned two things. One was that these people didn't have indoor plumbing. The toilet was nothing more than a hole in the ground surrounded by a circle of stones. Not exactly comfy. The second thing was that the mystery of why this place smelled so bad was solved. I guess these people hadn't figured out that an outhouse should definitely be out of the house. Man, it smelled like a sick elephant had been using this thing. But what the heck, it wasn't my house and I had to go bad. So I held my breath against the stink and then took about 5 minutes to figure out how to undo the leather clothes. I guess these people hadn't yet discovered zippers either. It was during this that I realized the furs I had been wearing were gone. I guess somebody took them while I was unconscious. Yeah, that was fine by me, because if I'd had to get through another layer, I would have wet myself for sure. After I finished, I hurried across the stone hut to catch up. I didn't know what I was expecting to find outside, so I guess no matter what I saw would have been a surprise. But when I stepped outside, I had to stop and catch my breath, because I had just stepped into another world, and it was like nothing I had ever seen before. The hut I had just come from was in the middle of a village of stone huts. They all looked the same, more or less, with stone walls and roofs made of woven branches and straw. There were no decorations of any kind to distinguish one from the next. Some had smoke curling up from stone chimneys, which meant there were fires burning inside for cooking and for heat. The roads and pathways that snaked between the huts were dirt, well-worn and narrow. And why not? It's not like they had to worry about cars or anything. All the huts were built around a big grassy area, kind of like a town square, with a large round platform about 10 feet across at its center. The base of the platform was made of stones like the huts, and it was topped by a surface made of lashed-together logs. The setup reminded me of those towns that have a gazebo in the center of a park for concerts and stuff. But the stage was empty now. No shows today. The village was busy with people doing whatever people do in a village like this. They were hurrying here and there, some carrying baskets of food, others moving a herd of goats. They all wore the same kind of leather clothes I was wearing. So even though I felt out of place, I probably didn't look it. The people who looked out of place were Osa and Lore. As I described them to you, they were both tall, dark-skinned,
and athletic-looking. There were no other people of color in this village. Just the opposite. The people of Denduron were the palest people I had ever seen in my life. It was like they never saw a day of sun in their lives. That was strange, because even though it happened to be overcast just then, I had seen three suns in the sky from on top of the mountain. Could it be that the suns here didn't give you a tan? Or was it mostly always overcast, like Seattle or something? Whatever the reason, it was pretty obvious that Ossa and Lore were not from Denduron, just as they had said. The village had been cut out of a forest. Looking one way, beyond the huts, was vast farmland. I could see many people working out there, tending to crops. Looking off in the opposite direction, I saw the mountain where Uncle Press and I had made our idiot bobsled run to escape the quigs. Any other direction showed nothing but forest. Not that I'm an expert anthropologist or anything, but this first brief look at the village made me think of books and movies I'd seen about Europe back in medieval days. The only thing missing was some huge castle that loomed over the village. Ossa and Lore let me stand there for a few minutes so I could take in the surroundings. I was about to join them when suddenly I was grabbed from behind and spun around.
Agatavan Bursa!
It was a little guy with long, scraggly hair, an eye patch over one eye, and a smile that showed more spaces than teeth. On each of his fingers was a different ring that looked to be braided out of rope. 10 fingers, 10 rings. The guy was grubby, but he sure liked jewelry. I had no idea what he wanted, until he shoved a furry-looking thing at me. I jumped back, but then realized it was some kind of woolly shirt, like a sweater.
Agatavan,
he said again with a smile as he shoved the piece of clothing at me. I figured he was harmless and that he wanted me to take the thing. Hey, what the heck? Maybe it was a local welcome custom. It was kind of chilly, and this leather shirt thing I was wearing wasn't keeping me all that warm. So I smiled back at him and reached for it. But just as I was about to take it, the little guy pulled it back, held out his hand, and rubbed his fingers together. Yes, he was giving me the international sign. No, I guess it was more the intergalactic sign for, you want it, you pay for it. This weird little guy was trying to strike a deal for the sweater.
Figgis, leave him be, said Ossa, as she stepped between us.
Mababa can for me,
said the little guy innocently. At least I think it was innocently. His language made no sense to me. Ossa looked at Figgis and said,
he has only just arrived. Go sell your wares somewhere else.
The guy was a salesman. He seemed to deflate in disappointment and started to walk away, but then he turned back and gave me a sly, toothless smile. From out of his grungy shirt, he held up a shiny red apple, trying to tempt me. It looked good.
Go,
commanded Ossa. Figgis snarled at her and ran away.
Figgis would sell you his breath if he could, she explained. They say he wears that patch because he sold his eye to a blind man.
Nice. That's a fairly disgusting image. Ossa, I asked, are you from Earth? Ossa laughed and looked to Lore to share the joke that I didn't get. Lore didn't laugh back. Big surprise.
Why do you think that? She asked.
You know English, I said.
You are wrong, Pendragon, she said. I do not understand a word of English. Come.
She left me there and continued walking with Lore. Huh? I could be mistaken, but I thought sure we were speaking English. I should know. Aside from a little classroom Spanish, it's the only language I know. This was getting frustrating. Every time I thought I was starting to get a handle on things, something would come along and pull the rug out from under me. I figured I'd better get used to it. Ossa and Lore were already way ahead of me, so I had to run to catch up. I had to jog to keep pace with their long strides while making sure to keep Ossa between me and Lore. I liked the mom, but I didn't trust the daughter. I kept catching her throwing me these
You aren't worthy to breathe air that could go to someone more deserving looks. She was giving off a major cold vibe. I figured it would be best to stay out of her way.
I don't understand, I said to Osa. How can you say you don't know English if you're speaking it?
I am not speaking English, she answered. You are speaking English. I am speaking the language from Zada, which is our home territory.
Sounds like English to me, I said.
Of course it does. That is because you are a traveler.
This was getting more confusing by the second. So you're saying that travelers understand all languages? Logical question, right?
No,
came the illogical reply.
Travelers hear all languages as their own, and when they speak, others will understand them, no matter what their native language.
Cool! If this were true, maybe I'd have a shot at getting better than my usual lousy C in Spanish class. Still, something didn't fit. Okay, so how come when that Figgis guy spoke, it sounded like blah 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 to me? Suddenly, Lore jumped in front of me. I had to put on the brakes or walk into her. That would have hurt.
Because maybe you are not a traveler,
she said with a challenging snarl. Suddenly it all came clear. Lore didn't think I was who I was. That's why she was acting all strange and aggressive. Of course, I wasn't even sure myself who I was supposed to be, so there wasn't anything I could say to convince her that I was me, or I was who I was, or... you get the idea. Again, Osa came to my rescue, saying,
The reason you did not understand Figgis is that you have not yet learned to hear. You understand us because we are travelers, but Figgis is not. You must learn to hear without trying to listen.
Say what? Hear without listening? That sounded like fortune cookie logic.
How can he be a traveler? He is just a boy, Lore said to her mother vehemently. He is soft and frightened. He will do more harm than good.
Wow. How's that for an ego pounding? Ouch. Unfortunately, though, she was right. I was soft and frightened. Maybe I wasn't a traveler after all. Frankly, it wouldn't kill me to find out I wasn't, no matter how much it would have helped my Spanish grades. I was beginning to think that maybe this was all some big mistake and they would send me home. Osa looked at me with those dark, knowing eyes, but spoke to Lore, saying,
No, Pendragon is a traveler, but he has much to learn.
Then she looked at her daughter and said,
And you seem to forget that you are but a child yourself.
Lore stormed off in a huff. I got the feeling she didn't like being told she was wrong. Osa turned to me and said,
You will find that she is not always so angry.
Hey, no big deal, I shot back. Just so long as she isn't angry at me. Osa smiled and walked on. I followed, and she began to tell me about Denduron.
The people who live in this village are a tribe called the Malago, she began. As you can see, they live a simple life. They grow all of their own food and live peacefully with the other tribes of Denduron.
Malago. Uncle Press had used that word just before those knights showed up. He said they'd find me, so I guess they are the good guys. What about those knight-looking guys who attacked Uncle Press? I asked. Are they Malago, too?
No,
answered Osa.
That is what I want to show you.
We continued walking out of the village and along a path in the woods for about a quarter of a mile. I judge all distances by the track at Stony Brook High. It's a quarter of a mile around, and it felt like we walked about the distance of that track. We broke out of the woods into a clearing, and I was yet again hit with an amazing sight. Remember how I said the only thing missing from this medieval village was a big old castle looming over it? Well, as it turns out, there was a big old castle. It just wasn't doing any looming. Here's what I saw. When we emerged from the path through the trees, we came upon a huge open field of grass. We walked across this rolling field until we came to a cliff on the far side. Down below the cliff was water. Yes, we are at the edge of an ocean as vast and as blue as the Atlantic. The sea was to my right, and I turned to look down the coast, an uneven, craggy shoreline with big rocky cliffs. I saw that the cliff we were on was actually one side of an inlet. Looking down over the edge, I saw wave after wave of seawater crashing on the rocks below. Far below. We were so high above the water, I started getting sweaty palms. I'm not good with heights. I looked up and straight ahead to the cliff on the far side of the inlet to see that the land on top was covered with more lush seagrass that waved in the ocean breeze. Then what I saw below that grass took my breath away. Built right into the face of the cliff was a monster fortress. It looked as if it were literally carved out of the rock that made up the bluff. I could see several levels of stone balconies where knights like the ones who attacked Uncle Press were keeping guard. They marched back and forth with lethal-looking spears over their shoulders. I'm not exactly sure what they were guarding against. Marauding fish, I suppose. I counted 5 levels of balconies, so this fortress was big. Osa must have read my mind because she said,
"You are only seeing the outside wall of the palace. It is built far into the cliff. It is a village in itself."
From what I saw so far, these people didn't have any heavy-duty construction equipment, so this place was chiseled out of the rock by hand. It must have taken centuries to dig such a huge building out of hard rock using simple tools.
"There have always been 2 tribes here," she continued. "The Malago work the land. The Bedouin are the soldiers and rulers. At one time, many of the tribes of Denderon were at war. The Bedouin protected the Malago from marauders, and in return, the Malago provided food. Each tribe relied upon the other, while they remained very much apart. It lasted that way for centuries, with both tribes living in relative harmony. But the Bedouin were powerful, and power can lead to arrogance. It was forbidden for a Malago to marry a Bedouin, or even to become friends. As so often happens in situations like this, the Bedouin began to look upon the Malago as their slaves."
"But still, they protect the Malago, right?" I asked.
"There have not been invaders here for many years. The need for protection no longer exists," said Osa.
"So the Malago guys still do all the work, and the Bedouin guys do what?"
"That is a good question. The Bedouin are ruled by a royal family, with the role of monarch passed down to the eldest child. There was a time, not too long ago, that the Bedouin monarch wanted to break down the barriers between the 2 tribes and allow them to become one. But he died and left the monarchy to his firstborn. There are some who believe that the father was murdered by those who did not want the Bedouin to give up their superior position."
"And let me guess, the new monarch likes having slaves and wants to keep the 2 tribes apart," I said.
"Yes," she said. "The Malago are afraid to even say the name. Kagan."
There was that name again. I was beginning to get the picture, and I didn't like it. "The knights who attacked Uncle Press thought he was spying on Kagan," I said. "But Uncle Press pretended that he was a miner. Are there mines here?"
"Yes,"
she said with a sad breath.
"That is the worst part of the story."
"Oh, great. It gets worse. Just what I wanted to hear." But before Osa could continue, I heard the sound of a far-off drum. It was a steady, booming sound that came from the direction of the Malago village. Lore ran up to us and said breathlessly,
"It is the transfer. Hurry!"
She took off, running back the way we came. Osa looked at me and said with concern,
"Stay close to me. Do not let them see you."
With that, she took off after Lore. As I told you, these 2 were athletes, but I didn't care how fast they were. I was going to keep up with them. I caught up and kept right on Osa's tail as we beat feet along the path back to the Malago village. Good thing it was only about a half mile away, or I would have bonked for sure.